Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, everybody. You're listening to Internet Art here on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like the shows that we put out and you want to support this channel and all the things that it does, you should go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/pledge and throw us a few dollars so that we can pay for the one light bulb that is in this studio and all the other important goodies that make this possible.
She's my witch.
See you kids on the back end of the theme music. Stay tuned for more. Mess around
and you. Skeptic among believers and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always
in the often erotic world of the witch.
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Into the Dark, the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We have a really fun show for you today. I'm going to be talking to Al Cummins, who's in the studio right now, Dr. PhD from the University of Bristol, and one of the hosts of the Radio Free Golgotha podcast, and also a prolific author and editor on topics of magic, folklore, and the occult, including one of my personal favorites, Cipriana Old World, and the series that is slowly growing out of that. Al, hey, hi.
Hello.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Could you come closer to the microphone a little bit? And
how's that? Is that any better?
Wait, what if I do this? Okay, try it again.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, wait. I think you were on. Ha. Wait, one more time.
Hello.
Okay, no. I figured it out. Okay, sorry. Computers and the radio are, you know, it's like the Quran says of life. It's a joy and a pastime, but not to be taken terribly seriously. Anyway, so I'm really glad you came on. And there's so much to talk about, but one of the things that I really want to talk about first is Cipriana and Saint Cyprian. So, like, I first came across your work with Cipriana Old World, which is a collection of texts about Saint Cyprian, who is a official saint of the Roman Catholic and also Eastern Orthodox churches, and the unofficial patron saint of folk magic, necromancy, and finding buried treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this start? Tell me about, like, you first finding out about Saint Cyprian, you putting this together. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the process there?
Well, it started really with I made a pilgrimage to a relatively famous hoodoo shop in California around my birthday a number of years ago. And I was completing I can't remember if I was doing my master's or if I'd actually started my PhD at that point. But it was on the history of magic. And so I asked the lady that runs the store, could she recommend any candles, any services, any things that this you know, conjure shop, this hoodoo candle store and everything else could offer me. And she, you know, inquired as to what my family background was, which is Irish Catholic. So she directed me towards the saints, and specifically Saint Cyprian of Antioch as a patron saint of occultists, and occultist has that wonderful way of covering both the people that do the thing and the people that think about the people that do the thing.
Right.
So this quality of, like, oh, you're doing something about the history of magic and you're looking at magic books, these are all things that fall kind of under the purview of this sorcerer saint, this saint of necromancy. And so I bought a candle that she fixed for me and dressed, and from there I just continued a relationship over the years. Had a little space allotted to him, and I would serve him on the day that I was told that was, you know, the auspicious day. But from there, really getting more interested in the actual text. He's He's a 3rd century saint, it's supposed. And he's kind of nicely cloaked in myth and the you know, tenebration of historical account meeting mythic record in this way of that saints often have, right? So he's meant to have been a bishop of Antioch, and yet there don't seem to be many records of him, despite the fact that, you know, they were pretty good record keepers even at that point, which is suspicious. There's also a wider historical... it's sometimes called a confusion. I think that kind of talks down a little bit to the dead, but there's this idea that there are two Cyprians, at least two Cyprians, the Cyprian of Antioch and the Cyprian of Carthage. Cyprian of Carthage is acknowledged as one of the church doctors. He writes an awful lot of theology and gets really into the philosophy of the kinds of Christianity that he's interested in. And his image is elided with that of St. Cyprian of Antioch. So if you see that blue and purple robed bishop with the mitre and the book, crucially, you're probably looking at something that was originally created for Cyprian of Carthage, but there's this kind of elision that occurs over time, so picking the different parts of it become something to bear in mind. But overall, I think his the influence of him is felt through things like the spread of the Golden Legend, which is like this, you know, early medieval text that that goes everywhere and spreads all of these myths about various saints and certainly plays up their miracles and their magic. And Cyprian is interesting in that he parallels in reverse King Solomon, who is said to have been, you know, very wise and given this wisdom by God,
right?
Who is then eventually brought low by a terrible, corrupting foreign woman, the Queen of Sheba, getting into kowtow to these foreign idols.
Tisk tisk.
Yeah. So Cyprian plays the opposite role. He starts out, supposedly, his story begins with him as a dodgy necromancer for hire doing love spells on the fly. And
though, I mean, I feel like his love spells aren't really like, there's love spells and then there's what Cyprian did, which seems a bit more like demonic kidnapping.
The term often used in the study of them is erotic malefic workings. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Sorry, I love that. I should stop laughing. go on.
So Cyprian is this dodgy love potion salesman, effectively, supposedly, kicking around Antioch. And either he, depending on which version of the story, or another gentleman falls head over heels in lust with the very pious, very chaste Saint Justina. And so the root story is that Cyprian attempts to force her to love either him or his client, and she breaks this pagan magic with the power of the cross. And at this point, Cyprian is... convinced that he too should convert to Christianity, as it kind of, because it has the better magic, like,
right?
Like less because, you know, this is the way of righteousness. Although he obviously confesses his previous sins and attempts to ingratiate himself with the church leaders, and eventually is supposed to become a bishop. But if you read the accounts, the confession of Cyprian and the conversion of Cyprian later, and a couple of other books. Certainly the early ones, really it's Justina who's the star, and Cyprian is this other character who she converts, and they become, you know, bosom buddies, and they supposedly are martyred together as well, depending on which accounts, again, you read. But what's fascinating to me is that we have this figure of a pagan magician who converts to Christianity and is held as a great example of Christian magic as well. But it's mainly the counter magic. But it's also this idea of seeking power rather than any kind of sense of a it beginning with some kind of change of conscience. And he's interesting for various other reasons that I'm sure we'll go into. But I hope that's a kind of like grounding for people.
Oh yeah, definitely.
His character. He's basically like, if you look at the grimoire tradition in Europe, you can kind of split it between. What gets called the Solomonic tradition, attributing these magical books to Solomon, and specifically, usually, the keys that Solomon uses to command spirits, and sometimes demons specifically, to build the great temple for him, for instance. And that's certainly the English language main grimoire sets of traditions is attributing things to Solomon. If you look at Spanish and Portuguese speaking regions, there main saint or the main author that they attribute their works to is Cyprian. So this, the idea of the Book of Cyprian being this kind of mythic text as well and having its own mythic weight and history to it, that it's a book you're supposedly only able to see in dream by some accounts. It's a book that you can only read at midnight at certain times of the year, according to other accounts. And so there's all this mythic understanding and use and engagement with magical text, from the ink to the pages, to how it's read, to how it's not meant to be read, or where it's and when it's not meant to be read. And this, as someone that's interested in studying books about magic and books of magic, is especially interesting to me.
That's fantastic. And so, okay, so you edited a collection of texts sort of introducing Cyprian, but also that this role that he played in the magical traditions of Europe, which was Cyprian's old role, but that was not the first. I mean, that was the first, but like that is certainly not the last. You also have done the Immaterial Book.
Oh, right. Yeah. So I'm not the sole editor, I should point out. I have a team behind me. My best friend, Jesse Hathaway Diaz, who I also do Radio Free Golgotha with, he and I form what we're calling a little imprint of Revelor Press, called Folk Necromancy and Transmission, which is looking at this idea of what is necromancy, not as a grandiose, not that we've got anything wrong with grandiose black robes, but like the stuff that isn't necessarily regarded as quote unquote high ceremonial necromancy. What's the interaction with the dead and ghosts and ancestors that people have on a kind of daily basis? What are the folk traditions and folk ways and food ways of a relationship between the living and the dead?
The sort of DIY punk scene of necromancy.
Yeah, exactly. So we've been working on a couple of texts that have mainly so far kind of cohered a little bit around Cyprian. So the Old World, Cyprian Old World, was done with my friend Jesse, and also our friend Dr. Jen Zart, who is also runs Revelor Press, and has a keen eye as an editrix. And so we gathered together a bunch of people we knew who had things to say about Cyprian, and started with a retranslation of the Greek of one of the foundational myths of Cyprian that was translated by Matthew Barclay, who's an excellent independent classicist and scholar, and then traced it through a variety of things, the way Cyprian turns up in a lot of northern traditions and a lot of Swedish and Danish black books is the tradition of this. Again, this folk necromancy of keeping a receipt book or a book of spells, if you like. But those spells can be anything from how to cure your sheep of, foot rot, to how to curse your neighbor by firing a shotgun full of magic rocks over their house. It's a fascinating admixture of all these different things. And so seeing how Cyprian crops up there and following him throughout Europe and into particularly Iberia, where like that kind of Portuguese influences and context, it becomes very important. And we're very lucky to have Jose Leitao, who's a scholar of Cyprian and of Iberia and the Portuguese cultural context. So yeah, we were very lucky to be able to publish his book about the myths of Cyprian's book, which he called the Immaterial Book of Cyprian. He's already released his version of the Book of Cyprian through Hadean Press, which if you're interested in this, I really recommend checking out. It's not only is it a vast storehouse of sources and texts about the Cyprianic tradition, it's also he's also done extensive commentary on it, and it's a great text. So we've put out a couple of those, and the hope is to put out a couple more. We want to do one concentrating on Cyprian in the New World, as it quote unquote New World, how he pops up in the living traditions of Dominican 21 divisions, sometimes called Dominican voodoo back in the day, where he pops up as a mask or a syncretized saint with various spirits in African diasporic traditions, and also in Mexican Curandismo, and a whole set of other folk traditions, but living folk traditions. So the idea of the next one will be that we're still gathering people and sources, and hopefully some little old ladies that will tell us some
interesting spells that can be done with him. And then the other one we're attempting to do kind of at the same time, possibly a little bit after, is a collection more specifically on Justina and on lady exorcists and female necromancers. And so the idea of doing a ladies' night feels very, very appealing in terms of looking at that this fascinating set of traditions of a variety of exorcistesses, if you like.
That's really fantastic. And you're also working, I think, you mentioned on another book. Is it too early to talk about that
one? I can certainly, I mean, I've been working on it a while. I can't talk about publishing stuff because it's in its kind of stage of coming together in its final form. But I can definitely talk about the text that it's based on. I love expounding on it. It's a book, it's two texts that are bound together in a single volume in the British Library under the library entry of Additional Manuscript 36674. But the two texts that I'm concerned with are one called The Excellent Book of the Art of Magic, and the other, which is its attendant, Visions, which is the journal of the scrying record that accompanied the writing of the grimoire. So what's fascinating about it already is that we don't just have this manual saying, like, okay, you need to draw a circle like this, and then face this direction and then say this conjuration, as a lot of grimoires kind of do.
Yeah.
Rather, we have the text of, like, what you're meant to do to summon spirits, because that's what it's concerned with. But then you also have their dream journal and their record of the visions they were having, where spirits were turning up and telling them, okay, you need to do this thing, and then they would put that in the book. So we get the behind the scenes, we get the director's cut.
Yeah, the liner notes.
The liner notes, yeah, the audio commentary on the thing itself. So it's already, I think, interesting in those terms. We know that it's dated very specifically to a set of operations performed in 1567, which is a number of years before similar scrying operations by Dr. John Dee and Edward Kelly, who's they're some of the more well-known people attempting spirit conjuration and contact and communion using a showstone, using scrying, a crystal ball of sorts. Right. And the people that we're pretty sure were doing, that wrote the excellent book of the Art of Magic, are Humphrey Gilbert and John Davis, who were known associates of Dee and Kelly. And so this also looks like a precursor to a bunch of the angelical or Enochian operations as well.
Right.
Not specifically, the same spirits don't necessarily turn up, except in a couple of cases there are a couple of the same spirits that turn up, which aren't unique to the Enochian workings either. But the way of doing it certainly seems like getting a process for it. And the other reasons I'm interested in it are around the fact that it conjures, the means of conjuration has a particular set of senior spirits that are called from the four directions, the four kings or the four regents, as I prefer, which form this this stream of medieval and early modern spirit conjuration technology, if you like, that was kind of either forgotten about or deliberately suppressed. Mm. It's a way of doing magic that honors this particular set of practices that, if we take as a general idea of, like, calling the quarters, as it's often called in some modern paganism, that idea itself, to borrow Professor Hutton's kind of thesis or parts of it, calling the quarters of some sort is a tradition of ritual magic that we can trace all the way back to Mesopotamia, and probably further if we have better records. Certainly some of the people looking at, like, proto-Egyptian asterisms are also saying that there are similar kinds of things going on there. And so that really interests me, is this, like, ongoing set of traditions around spirit conjuration, that it isn't just finding a shiny crystal ball and staring into it and right. You hear voices. Like, you're drawing on earlier practices. And what my favorite thing about the excellent book of the Art of Magic and its visions is that it details the ghosts of dead magicians turning up for Gilbert and Davis to tell them how to do magic. So this isn't just necromancy. This is a necromancy of necromancy.
Oh my, sorry. That's just, yeah, that's meta necro. Yeah. It's like, yeah. I was going to make another simile and I won't. But the point is, like, that's fascinating and that's fantastic. So you've been working on this for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it feels like, because this is linked to such long standing traditions, like, there's a way in which this book could possibly never be done. Like, it could sort of go on forever, because it's like sort of the you have to sort of unfold the history of magic itself
a little bit,
to properly
like cite. why are these because they're not just magicians, like, oh, this guy is some dead magician who says he was around in the 1400s. They're like the famousest magicians. Solomon, Adam, who is arguably the first magician, and certainly there's a set of magical traditions that honor him as the first magician.
Right. I mean, there's certainly that old, I mean, we were talking about this in a bar recently, but like that old, I want to call it an Elizabethan notion, but I feel like that's, you know, it's a wider time frame, but like the idea of like the language that Adam used to name the animals was a sort of perfect language that actually had magical efficacy in the world. And if one were to tap into it, they could do things by saying things in the purest way. That's a tangent. Okay, so like Adam, Solomon, anyone else?
Yeah.
Who are some of these heavy hitters?
Agrippa, Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa, who's only passed away recently relatively recently in 1567, when these operations and these dreams of these dead magicians turning up occurs. So they have, you know, one of the most important figures in Renaissance occultism, who's, you know, publishes this voluminous and encyclopedic 3 books on occult philosophy, which manages to both marry older Greco-Roman magic and the kind of pagan, but let's not concern ourselves with that stuff, that the Renaissance thinkers and humanists are very interested in, with a bunch of new appropriations of Jewish Kabbalah in some other interesting directions, and Christianizing Kabbalah more formally as a not just a cosmogony, not just a map of how the Almighty creates the realm of Asir, of Earth and everything in between that and him, but also that it becomes a ladder that these Christian Kabbalists are attempting to climb back up to achieve some kind of union with the Godhead. So Agrippa, also Roger Bacon, who is less well known. He's an alchemist and a natural philosopher, and he has the interesting reputation as someone that wrote a lot of stuff about alchemy, but very few texts definitely ascribed, or very few texts that we know he wrote. So he was known as this author of many things on alchemy. He's also regarded as having cracked how to make a scrying mirror that could see things at a distance, and also have created a brazen head that talked, and a variety of other kinds of magical operations. And he's less well known, but he's a fascinating character. He's very instrumental in bringing some Arabic notions of optics into general Western European science and proto-science, but also occultism, the idea of the rays of the stars having being able to make talismanic astrological objects because you can perfectly capture and manipulate light.
Which is, of course, a thing that we're almost dealing with. I mean, the eclipse, you had so many people trying to charge water and so on based on those same principles. That's fantastic. Okay, so like you've been doing this research for a long time, but you're not just a scholar, which is not to minimize the scholarship.
There's a lot
going on. But you're not just a scholar, you're also, you practice a lot of these, especially divination. Mm-hmm. And I know you do divination, and I know you've at least spoken about geomancy, but like what forms of divination do you tend to gravitate to?
So I started with tarot, as a lot of people do, and I was, at the time when I was a teenager, I was very interested in like Hermetic Kabbalah and how like Golden Dawny stuff fit with and Crowley's Thelema fit with tarot, which it was kind of forced into doing a lot by like Levy and various other 19th century occultists. So I was interested in tarot initially, but I'm also these days I've been reading for over a decade, I guess, and I've been reading professionally for people for almost that long as well. And the main things I use are tarot. I also read playing cards, which, confusingly, I guess tarot is also a form of cartomancy. But playing cards from much more of a African-American conjure tradition, set of traditions. One of my favorite books on it is, I love expounding, is Professor Charles Porterfield's A Deck of Spells, which is a really, really great book. It's half how to read cards, and the other half is how to use cards in folk magic.
Cool. Okay. Yeah.
It's great. I very much recommend. It's a little chat book. I think you can get it for like under $10 off of the internet. I'd recommend that. But yes, I also read Geomancy as well, which is a slightly lesser known form of divination. I'm happy to bang on about that if you.
I mean, honestly, the thing is, like, with Geomancy is like that, you know, in the same way that like cartomancy, like, you know, these are broader terms.
Yeah.
And I've heard so many different things referred to as geomancy. So like when you do geomancy, what geomancy do you, or geomancies do you do?
So the main way we can kind of do a typology of it is a bunch of things that get called like land magic. So whether that's actually following ley lines or dragon lines or navigating an interaction between you and large features of landscape, right? That's sometimes called a kind of geomancy. What I do is a lot closer to what looks like a European version of the I Ching. It's computational. It relies on processing odd or even numbers into a definitive answer. So whereas the I Ching is made of 64 hexagrams, right?
Yeah.
A figure is six broken or unbroken lines. Geomancy only has four lines, which represent the four elements on the earth. So it's geomancy because it is one of the ways of passing that name is that it deals with all worldly affairs, all things in the world, and the world, by this kind of occult philosophical take, is elementated, as Agrippa puts it, out of the four elements of fire, air, water, and earth. So the four lines that are broken or unbroken, or one dot or two dots that make up a geomantic figure, mean that there are only 16 figures in geomancy. There are only 16 different answers it can give, but there's a whole system of generating them and processing them through some relatively simple to show but hard to describe mathematical processes that creates a chart that mirrors the astrological charts of, say, like a horary reading, where you would ask an astrologer, you know, tell me about this, you know, tell me about the journey I'm about to go on. And they will use that snapshot of the moment that you ask that question to decode what the stars are meant to be doing and how they're, crucially, how they're aspected to each other to divine an answer to your question, right? Mm. So geomancy uses, say, the 12 houses of the heavens. So when you do a full geomantic chart, you are answering a specific question, you know, will I get the job? You know, is this a good relationship to pursue? All of those classic divination questions.
Right.
But you're also characterizing, you're also giving a figure to each of the 12 areas of someone's life, of their money, their siblings, their home, their career, their partnerships. Like, all of these different houses are used. And geomancy is sometimes called the daughter or the sister of astrology, in that it relies on an awful lot of astrological symbolism. Symbolism is kind of a dirty word, but like a lot of the grammar and language of the stars, without actually having to do any of the astronomy of measuring where the stars actually are. So because it's about the influence of the stars, that astral virtue on the earth, like, how does this actually get grounded? How does it actually impact in your life?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I really like kind of proselytizing for geomancy, because it was incredibly popular in the early modern period. And it's also interesting in terms of like a world stage of the world history of magic and divination, because it's literally based in a bunch of Arabic forms of divination and an Arabic geomancy, al-ramal, sand cutting, as it's sometimes called, is really complicated and practiced today by some incredible experts. There's a one famous set of tests where you have to answer 99 different questions accurately before you're kind of like considered by these traditions to be like a professional.
That's
like
fantastic.
A bar that you have to pass, a bar exam that you have to pass.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like magic, like at least like in the United States and all of other places, there's just not like a guild system like there might have been. Mm-hmm. The idea of like taking magic seriously as a trade, almost, with credentials and criteria. Okay, so you've been doing readings for people for 10 years professionally, and like, I feel like when people talk about getting a reading, sometimes they have like a very specific question they want to have answered, and sometimes it's just like a basic, like, I think a lot of people treat this sort of stuff, especially like if tarot readings, like, it's a fun Mm-hmm. Oh, there's danger coming in my relationship. Maybe my boyfriend doesn't like me anymore or something like that, which, I mean, now that I say it out loud, is actually not a very fun thing to hear. it's actually quite distressing. But, like, how can people use divination, especially something like, say, like geomancy, which provides what seems to be a very holistic mm-hmm. view of what's going on?
Well, the general way that people divide up how they're approaching divination, as you say, comes from either this kind of idea of a quote-unquote general life reading, which can just be a checkup, and plenty of other divination traditions across the world do this as well. It's not an uncommon thing. The underlying question could be said to be, what do I need to know about where I'm at right now? You know, it's something as broad as that. Geomancy answers some more specific questions. Like, it kind of relies on answering your particular question about career or love or whatever, whether or not the lawsuit is going to go your way. And if it's not, what I can do about it, crucially, which is the other thing I want to bang on about that I think is very important, is prescription and proscription, is actual, not just diagnosing something, but trying to work out what to do about it. So you can do the specific asking of a question with geomancy, but it will then locate that in a mass of other factors of things going on in your life, and they might or might not be significant, and the ways in which you can find through the way the chart, through reading the chart, that yes, here's the definite answer to your question, yes or no, this will happen or won't happen, if that's what you're asking. But also, you know, it can point out something that the client might not be aware of at present as well, which is a weird one when you're like, there's this thing you don't know, and I'm about to tell you as much as I can work out from what I don't know about it. And I guess you know, I like to check in with my clients every, at least every month, and see if the things that are sometimes the blind bits of reading, require further investigation.
Right.
But I much prefer working with my clients over small incremental changes and steering their projects and their work rather than, promising to tell them everything about their future in one, splat in their lap. And then washing my hands of any further contact.
I mean, what would you even do with that kind of information?
Right. And this is a thing that I think is important to talk about with divination as well. Like, people do come to diviners with specific problems and specific things that they need help with, finding a place to live, a variety of real fundamental things that they need fixing, that they need solutions for, they need help fixing or fixing for themselves, or achieving or preventing. But people also come to diviners, and it's one of my favorite things to do, for want of a better term, creative projects. I work with dancers and artists and performers of various sorts and managers of performers, who are looking at ways in which they can get new perspectives on their art, on their projects, on their practices. And so, yes, it can be really helpful for dealing with, processing one's emotional, for want of a better term, like development or something. Yeah. But it can also be there for a variety of other forms of personal development, of especially creativity. You know, when you throw tarot cards, you're looking at this mass of polyvalent symbol sets that can provide perspectives and characterizations of things that can be useful perspectives on what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, that's one of the things that I like emphasizing, is that divination is not just for when you're desperate. You know, it can be for when you need to plan something, like anything, really.
Right. I mean, well, that's, the nice thing about, like, especially like folk craft and looking at that, like the day-to-day quotidian of magic. But like the thing about the relationship between magic and performance, I mean, like, you're not divorced from performance to some extent yourself, because I mean, you did used to travel with some people mm-hmm. as, I think, a performing poet, but also magician.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'm mm-hmm. not wrong about things. That's cool.
Right,
so, could you talk about that? It was like a traveling, because I actually prevented my, like, we were talking about, we touched this in like a conversation we were having, and I refused to hear anything about it until now, because I wanted to be fresh.
Didn't want to spoil it yourself.
Basically, yeah. So Go. What was that? Tell me about
Sure. Well, I worked as a semi-professional performance poet for a while. I would go into schools and teach different kinds of poetry to kids, slam poetry a lot of the time, because that kind of competitive form of it actually works pretty well for getting kids to do, you know, getting them to eat their greens of their poets and their classical literature by hiding it in the ice cream of calling it X Factor or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not learning until you use it to destroy someone else.
Exactly. So really, you know, getting them fired up in that way of using poetry to crush their enemies. Yeah, yeah. As we all do. So I was a semi-professional performance poet for a while, and one of the most fun and rewarding things I did was tour for a couple of years with a project called the Ladybird Collective, the Ladybird Project, which had a big top that it would take round festivals, so around the festival circuit in the UK. So along with, you know, festivals that you might be familiar with in terms of like Glastonbury and that kind of stuff, there's a whole host of smaller festivals, mainly music, but also dance and creative. Lots of sweaty people in a field somewhere in England or Scotland, listening to very loud music and having a wonderful bacchanalia of a time. So I was touring around with some excellent carnival friends, basically, and that was a beautiful thing to do, to turn up to a place and set up a big top to do creative writing workshops or puppetry workshops. I worked with a lot of puppeteers and make things with people at festivals, and then do a cabaret in the evening where I would compare and do a kind of a spoken word mixture of stand-up and philosophy and poetry and bits and pieces of magic. And then through that, I ended up being asked to be both an unofficial and official sight wizard for a bunch of festivals.
What would you do as a sight wizard?
I would generally, there were a variety of like perimeters, so ensuring that different spaces were usefully separated. So if a healing field was very near to, I mean, generally that this is, you know, bad planning, but if you did find that the space only provided, say, like the healing field, which is meant to be for, you know, diviners, but also, you know, massage therapists and a variety of other peoples, right next to, say, like a GABA hard techno stage, then like it would be, you know, important to navigate that kind of boundary and look after people who had taken way too much acid and were worried that they might be God, that kind of thing. And generally do readings for some of the organizers to help them do some of their planning as well. And generally just being a go-to resource for questions about weird things and also interactions. There's a lot of, you know, people who are very concerned with ensuring that the environmental impact of these wonderful festivals that they want to put on, some of which are happening in fields and woods and things, doesn't, you know, they're concerned about not just the ecological impact in terms of its like the physical like rubbish that's left there, but also the navigation of between the human civilized world and the uncivilized wilds kind of thing. And so being asked to kind of negotiate some of those boundaries and leave offerings and things at sites when things were being cleared up and that kind of stuff.
Would you, oh, I should probably, housekeeping. Hey, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn right now. Cool. So, sorry, I forgot, like, I have to do that. But there's really, it's just, yeah, there's a fact, ladies and gentlemen. But, so these spaces, I'm curious, because, like, you're clearly working with a sort of the latent magical or spiritual properties of the spaces in which these are taking place. Mm-hmm. But do you find at all that festivals themselves generate a kind of spirit? Because I remember I have a friend who told me once about something very spooky that happened to her at a Renaissance festival. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I should tell it, because I feel like it's sort of her story to tell. Mm-hmm. But like it puts me in mind of the idea that these spaces can generate mm-hmm. something. But can they? I mean, do you have any experience? Like,
yeah, I mean, one of the things I would do is circle the whole site and ensure that at various points there were talismanic objects or things buried or lines made or offerings poured out, libations to the earth and things like that, just to contain it in a way that was useful. And a couple of colleagues did suggest that
you know, an enterprising magician could take that kind of psychic noise that was generated from this many people having, you know, a wild sabbatic experience of some kind, with the, you know, reaching for these lasers in the middle of a wood, usually gurning your tits off.
Yeah.
That this generation of this energy, like, could be directed at things. And what I was interested in was grounding it in a way that was as safe as possible. That this didn't short out through. I've seen things that look like a bunch of psychic energy shorting out through a particular person that kind of burns them out in some way, or you know, freaks them out, or it's the kind of extreme version of a contact high. I feel like that kind of stuff can happen. So I didn't do anything specific other than keeping people safe and attempting to ensure that the energy moved healthily and circulated healthily. But sure, yeah, it certainly does that. And you're also into the ethics of, like, is it okay to use the psychic energy generated by people dancing and laughing and fucking and whatever else, like, in a without their knowledge? Like, is there a slight consent issue there?
Yeah,
I kind of think there is, but I also wouldn't necessarily say that it would always be a terrible thing to do festivals for a purpose, for a magical purpose. I've certainly been involved in people who were doing charity work where we were taking, say, we were testing housing solutions for refugees with building structures in different ways, like in fields, to test how they worked and to raise awareness of these kind of endeavors to make things that were useful for people displaced by war or natural disasters, and doing ritual in those spaces for the express purpose of piggybacking off this psychic clamor and energy and noise that's generated in order to achieve something with that and to make a mark in the world. And we tried to inform as many people as wanted to join the rituals when we do these at festivals.
Yeah.
You know, I think precisely because like, that's, you know, informed consent is a good and healthy and important and kind of necessary thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Actually, so there's something I've been meaning, because, like, I always thought it would be a good thing to talk about, and I've been having trouble finding someone, just so, you know. What do you think about the ethics of love spells? Like, because it seems like the importance of informed consent is very central to that.
Yeah.
And we see sort of the exact opposite of that with St. Cyprian,
right.
And his attempts. Like,
and the erotic malefic workings, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, how do you feel about that? Like, are love spells the sort of thing where, like, if, say, I don't know, if two people both know that they're sort of involving themselves in a love spell, it's fine? Or is there, can there be ethical love spells outside of that kind of parameter? What do you think about the sort of morality in place there? Mm-hmm.
I think there can definitely be ethical versions of love spells. I mean, in practice, most of the clients that I end up working with are not people that are after, you know, the equivalent of a sorceress roofie. They're after ways of improving themselves to bring new love into their lives. So either dealing with past trauma or, you know, just flexing their, like, you know, emotional intelligence and preparing the way for new love. It's a kind of road opening work very often. Or they're wanting some insight into something that's just about to start or has just started.
Yeah.
Right. So in that case, they're asking about a specific person, but they're not. I very rarely, and I turn them down, get prospective clients who are like, I want you to make Maggie from The Office fall in love with me. Like, that's where I draw the line.
Right.
This notion of, like, harmful love spells that force someone into loving someone else. The context for that really is Ovid Ovidian poetry, having this sense that love is a kind of affliction, is a kind of crazy, and is a kind of thing that sends you ill in some way. That love is essentially love sickness. And so the idea of a lot of these spells to torture someone into loving you are based on the idea of reverse engineering that love sickness. So one of the most famous examples that we find in, say, Christopher Irony's ancient love magic, ancient Greek love magic, I think it's called, which is one of the few studies on this, is the wording of a spell that we find in ancient Greece across the Mediterranean into Europe, into early modern Europe, into 19th century Russia, into the 101 books on the shelves of Barnes & Noble in the mind, body, soul section to this day, which is the operation that basically insists that he shall neither sleep nor wake nor eat nor drink nor stand nor sit nor do any of these things until he loved me, right? So it's reverse engineering this like pacing obsession that love sickness can feel like. Mm. So it's attempting to implant that in them, and then when they go and see their doctor and they're like, I can't sleep, or I'm just thinking about this person all the time, then in theory the doctor, if they haven't recognized the love spell of it, the hex of it, the whammy of it, then they will, you know, imply or come to the conclusion that they must have fallen in love with this person. So that's kind of the context for these a variety of the erotic malefic workings, is that it's already based around this idea that love is a kind of crazy, and it's which itself is based on the notion that the emotions, or the passions as they're called before about 1750, although the word is used, it comes from motion of the soul, the emotion of the soul, the idea of what moves you, literally the sensitive faculties of the Aristotelian tripartite soul that moves towards that which it deems pleasurable, or away from that which it deems painful, or towards that which is virtuous, or away from that which is viceful, to neologize for a second there.
Yeah.
And so the idea of the emotions themselves being this thing that unbalances us and results from an imbalance, whereas good health is by the ancient Greek models of that get called humoral theory or Galenism, have this notion that equilibrium is perfect balance, is the thing underlying not just beauty but like health and balance and harmony, crucially the harmony of the parts. So love magic is very often about poking that in a variety of ways. Heating people up, sweetening them, are the two main methods, and those can be employed in ways that aren't necessarily abnegating the free will of someone.
Yeah,
especially if I know quite a lot of practitioner couples who do love spells on each other, like openly and consensually, like to do a love ritual together, right? Yeah. To burn a couple candle or individual figural candles in red, you know, anointed in rose oils and things like that. It's a ritual that like reconnects and rebinds you to each other, like willingly and lovingly.
Yeah, it's a magical date night.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. Okay, cool. Thank you. Let's see here. We're running sort of low on time ish. So I just want to check my notes and see if there's anything we were going to talk about that we have yet to cover. So necromancy.
Yes.
I feel like necromancy's come up on this show before in limited sort of ways. Like I think I gave a long talk at some point about raising the dead and various forms of that, but of course necromancy is more broadly understood. What started your interest in necromancy, and also if you would please give a good working definition thereof?
Well, the term is sometimes contrasted to skeomancy, which is another form of divination. So necromancy is in this strict definition is magic and divination with bodies, basically with corpses or parts of corpses, whereas skeomancy is the divination by shades of the dead. So in theory, all the spirity stuff, not all the spirity stuff, but the primarily spirit manifestation stuff should be a form of skeomancy, quote unquote.
So like a seance would be skeomancy.
Yeah. Whereas the use of like a dead man's hand, like a hand of glory, would be a great example of that kind of like corpse component. Necromancy.
What would you use derail us completely for a second, but like I've only seen a hand of glory in the context of the Wicker Man, and I know that's like very, it's, I don't know, I mean the impression I've had is like that's kind of like a pop mysticism.
It is, but it has a grain of thing to it. The some hands of glory were said to make everyone in the house sleep. They're for thieves mainly, right?
Yeah.
They're for housebreakers. So if you use a hand of glory, one of the things that it will do is make everyone in the house sleep a sleep that they will not be woken from until you leave and, you know, take their stuff. So when they use that as a kind of sedative on on the policeman.
Yeah.
In the Wicker Man, in the proper Wicker Man.
Then there's
that kind of element to
it.
Yeah, for sure. As to why sleep and the dead are connected, that's a way bigger topic in general. You know, sleep being the cousin of death.
Right.
To quote that great occult scholar.
Bill, yeah. So necromancy then. So how did you... Actually, I realize we've sort of skipped the broader question. How did you get into all this? Because, like, I'm not to be skeptical, because, I mean, it is a show about witchcraft, but I'm always curious to see, like, where this starts. Because some people, you know, they have family members. Some people, they find a book at the right time. And some people, you know, they start being a goth kid. And then it all gets very serious and very real. And all of those are valid ways. Like, how did you... When did this start?
I think as a... Being a weird kid who's, you know, interested in world myth, who was playing... I mean, there are aspects of my superhero origin story that are basically fully lifted from a chick tract. Like, my dad played a lot of Dungeons & Dragons, and so I would play with him and his friends when I was very little. I kind of learned to write my name on character sheets and learned basic addition and maths through calculating THACO and things like that. So I was definitely interested in magic, but, like, not just in terms of wanting to live in that fantasy world, but the qualities of... to prosecutize about role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games, the qualities of collaborative storytelling and of ritual that goes into that, of these, you know, team of people coming together to tell a meaningful story, and that fascinated me and continues to fascinate me. The other things were, you know, I did Aikido from a very young age for quite a long time, so I had this like martial arts practice, which is good for like a whole bunch of things, but specifically, you know, Aikido is a thing that's concerned with, like, the translation that is sometimes given for it is way of harmonious ki, which is one of the Japanese forms for chi. So it's already has at its baseline in some degrees. It's a very recent martial art, relatively speaking. It's usually, there's some pre-war stuff to it, but there's definitely a post-war element, and its founder Ueshiba concocted it from a bunch of, it's a mixtape of Yaido and Jujutsu and various other bits and pieces, but he was also very involved in a variety of like Shinto traditions of magic and spirit work, allegedly. So I was already doing this thing that had this sense of, like, if you breathe in these particular ways, your body will feel like this and you're able to do these things. So there was a embodied component, and I think the flip side of that was that I suffered from insomnia from a pretty young age, fairly kind of, if not consistently, then it keeps cropping up. And the things when you're very young and kind of drifting in and out of exhaustion, the kinds of like lucid dreaming and those kinds of things were happening to me. And I was having, crucially, I was having experiences of things that felt like spirits. So learning how to talk to them properly and navigate those relationships was something that proved efficacious to me. Like, it wasn't just an abstract interest in spooky stuff. It was a sense of, like, actually, like, helping me navigate my life. The example I give is, I have a distinct memory of being, I don't know how old I was. I think I was maybe 5 or 6, and learning that I was a Scorpio, a sun sign Scorpio, and then, you know, learning what scorpions were and feeling like I got the raw end of the deal in terms of, you know, everyone else having like a centaur with a bow and arrow, that sounds cool, whereas the idea of having these horrible poisonous arthropods seemed horrible. And I would have these nightmares about scorpions covering my legs, and so I was terrified of getting out of the bed. And one night, in a particular state of lucidity, I ended up talking to these scorpions and saying, why are you bothering me? And they replied that they just really loved my feet and they had no intention of hurting me. And so if I left a foot out of the bed, they would be able to crawl over it and they wouldn't amass. And we could reach an accord, a compact of some kind with this thing that terrified me and that I thought was trying to kill me, that actually just wanted to be near me in some way. So this idea of, like, it's the one that sticks, and it's a slightly flippant example, but it's one of the things that feels like that was something that put me on this kind of path. And then I studied history of magic in the English Revolution at undergrad level, and ended up doing my master's in how astrology impacted the English Revolution as well, through the politics of both sides paying astrologers during the Civil War to say that God was on our side through the stars.
Yeah.
The social aspects of astrology being used and astrological magic being used for medicine, as well as the kind of environmental stuff of how we're mapping time and the changing of the seasons, and those kinds of things. And from there, I ended up doing my PhD on how magic and occult philosophy was used to map, manage, and kind of manipulate human emotionality. So a study of the passions, which again was about trying to work out how to use divination that I was doing in my like professional and personal life in like to be informed by my academic stuff. And there's often this kind of sets of disagreements between occultists who are primarily practitioners or occultists who are primarily researchers, where you know one claims that the other never gets their hands dirty and the other claims that they're just making it all up and they have no foundation. And of course the answer is not to do that classic, like the answer lies somewhere in the middle, but yeah. A combination of these things can form a concrescence of a practice informed both by being rooted in tradition and branching towards new experimentation. And that's really what the history of magic through, say, the excellent book shows, I think, is this mixture of a tradition of innovation, basically being both grounded in what's come before you and reaching as the blossoming buds of the tree of humanity, moving and getting to be alive for now and stretch to the sun and bring those nutrients back to that trunk and that solid foundation.
That is a really wonderful moment and perfectly timed because we're basically at the end. So thank you for coming on. This has been a wonderful conversation and I'm tickled pink by all this. If people wanted to check out the work you're doing and also possibly contact you for readings and things like that, where would they go? What would they do?
They can go to my website, which is www.alexandercummins, C-U-M-M-I-N-S without a G, .com. And you can find my consultations on that site. There's also recordings of some of my lectures and talks and some of my other interviews and some of my essays and blog posts about Cyprian. I also have a series about looking at the history of fairy through the lens of Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which was reading it was kind of vertiginous in a dark mirror of like, oh God, this is this is a little too close to home sometimes.
Right.
But yeah, you can find me there. I'm on the Facebooks as well, and you can check out Radio Free Golgotha on there and on its own website as well. And I am on the Twitters. I'm not very good at it, but I am there as at Al Gremlin, I think. But primarily, getting in touch with me at my email address, consultantsorcerer@gmail.com is the best one.
Okay, cool. And we'll put links up to all of this when this episode becomes a podcast in about a week, depending how things turn out. Cool. So thank you, everybody, for listening to Into the Dark. Stay tuned for the next show here on Radio Free Brooklyn. And also, if you have questions for our research department, please do not hesitate to send those to intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. That's Into the Dark, R as in radio, F as in free, and B as in Brooklyn @gmail.com, because that is, of course, where you're listening to this. And have a great magical pair of weeks, because we are gone for a fortnight, as is our wont. Great. And Al, any last words for the remaining 15 seconds of the show?
Thank you very much for having me, Cooper. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I appreciate you listening to me ramble. And yeah, thanks.
Pleasure was all mine. Gosh. And well, I mean, hopefully it was both mine and that of everyone who's been listening. Okay, have a good night.